Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Chuck Marsh, a permaculture teacher, designer, nursery person, and one of the pioneers of the modern eco-village movement, as he, along with Peter Bain, designed the Earthhaven Eco-Village in North Carolina here in the United States. Before we begin, a few reminders. Please like the show on Facebook or follow it on Twitter, and leave a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast site. Many new listeners find the show that way, and I'd like to get to 1,000 regular listeners by the end of the year, and we're on track to do so. Lastly, if you have an iOS or Android smartphone, download the Stitcher Radio app and listen to the show on the go, downloading the latest material over the air from your network or local Wi-Fi hotspot. Search for permaculture, and this show is the first entry. The title of this episode, A Neo-Horticultural Revival, comes from the end of the interview as Chuck provides us with his closing thoughts. On reflection of hearing his words, I feel that theme permeated the entire conversation, from where we begin with his biography and introduction to permaculture, to his international work with the Source Farm in Jamaica, and on to intentional communities and eco-villages. Nestled away in the mountains of North Carolina, Chuck is one of the elders of the American permaculture movement, as he was among the first U.S. students to take a permaculture design course, and did so with Bill Mollison in the early 1980s. Chuck's perspective on Bill and the direction originally intended for permaculture, included as part of our conversation here, provide insight on where to take this gift of a knowledge of permaculture as we move forward. If this is your first time listening to the show, many of the ideas we discuss should be fairly straightforward. We don't dive into anything that requires you to be steeped in permaculture literature and lore to follow. If you've been on this track for a while, there's plenty of knowledge shared with us from one of the first wave permaculture practitioners. Either way, I'm sure you'll find inspiration from this conversation. I've also included some additional thoughts after the close of the interview, including material that didn't make it into the show proper. I hope you enjoy this time with Chuck Marsh as much as I did. Now on to the interview. All right, then if you can give us a little bit about your background and how you came to permaculture, we can take it from there.
Okay, well, I was back in the late 60s and early 70s when I was in college. I was a biology major and with a strong focus on botany and ecology. And after I graduated, I continued to explore those areas. I decided I wasn't interested in being a scientist because it wasn't really grounded necessarily in practical applications. And I'm a big believer in finding practical applications for the knowledge that we manage to accumulate. So I started doing a lot of self-study on useful plants and soils and the practical applications of ecological-based research and things along those kind of lines. And so I was doing that pretty much on my own and making some pretty good progress. But then in 1980, Bill Mollison came into our region on his first tour through the United States and gave a talk and followed that up with a course. And I think it was the second or third permaculture design course ever taught in the United States that I was fortunate enough to be a part of at Long Branch Environmental Education Center in Leicester, North Carolina. So, you know, I got a good early dose of that. And the thing that really excited me about that was, aha, here's a system that puts all these separate studies under one whole systems kind of approach. And, you know, so it was a big tent in trying to look at, you know, all these different ways that we could apply what we've learned as a species from traditional peoples around the world, as well as the best of science and landscape architecture and all those kind of things, and a really workable whole system that could really, you know, had huge potential, I thought at the time, to make big changes in the world. So I just got right on board. It was just right up my alley and haven't really turned back since.
That really does tie you into the very early days of permaculture with 30 plus years of experience with this.
Yeah, I guess I would consider the folks that took that first set of courses were really the first wave. And the folks that were in that particular set of, I think it was five courses in the United States, many of those went on to be real leaders in the permaculture movement and continue to be to this day. So pretty fortunate in that way. And if gone through all the ups and downs of permaculturalists in North America's attempt to organize themselves and all the dysfunctional family disputes that also went along with that as well at the time. And I just hung in there. It really made a whole lot of sense for me and a lot of other folks who were found the same thing for themselves and really dedicated their lives to this work and continue to. So that's really good news.
I'd like to talk about the places that you've gone and the work that you've done, but one thing that I run into over and over again now that Bill is teaching less and less and that you have to go to often Australia or if he does some international teaching, what was it like to study with Bill Mollison?
I just thought it was wonderful. You know, I thought he was an absolutely brilliant man. His teaching style was largely story-oriented, and, you know, he reveled us with stories of his of Aboriginal peoples and their knowledge and wisdom. And for my opinion, it was just like a big love fest. It was just like all of us falling in love with his knowledge and information. And here was this absolutely brilliant and somewhat curmudgeonly man that really didn't care what anybody thought of him. He was who he was, and he wasn't apologizing for that. He was really quite inspiring. And another Australian man was his co-teacher, and that named Andrew Jeeves, who did a lot of the illustrations in the early permaculture books, too. It was really quite inspiring. I guess one of the challenges with all that was, okay, now that we've got the download, how do we follow up on that? And that's been something that we've all done in our own ways and our own times. So it's, I don't know what to say about that other than I think that we were fortunate enough to have a lot of people that really stuck with it and hung in there and persisted and continued to advance the field of permaculture, which is always really what Mollison intended. You know, he wanted this movement to be one that continued to grow and advance in a lot of ways and didn't necessarily just accept everything he said as gospel. And he certainly didn't want to be put up on a pedestal or a throne or anything along those kind of lines. He did everything he could to avoid that, which I thought was really a brilliant strategy, you know, not to fall into hero worship and not to really support that and allow people to continue to grow the movement. And one of the ways that that happens is through good communication between people on what their experiments are, what worked and what didn't work, so that knowledge base gets expanded. So it isn't just all of us working in our own little territories and holding that knowledge or information to ourselves, but how do we get it out there? How do we evolve this movement and this excellent design system into greater levels of adaptability for every place that it goes?
So that we can, as individuals, not dogmatically follow those early origins, but as we grow and share our own knowledge, permaculture, even though it has this core idea of ethics and principles, that the techniques and application in the places where we do this work continues to change and grow as the world changes around us?
Exactly. Just in the same way that an ecosystem adapts to the changes that happen within it, the movement needs to be able to do the same thing. It was important, I think, to have a common curriculum, as it were, to begin the work. But, you know, really a permaculture design course is just about a two-week long diving into these subjects and making some of these connections. And there's no way that you can teach everything that needs to be taught about ecosystems and how they function or forest or, you know, water and permaculture and anything like that in an hour and a half class. That's really just kind of a good introduction and kind of creates a context for exploring all these subjects in greater depth on our own and together.
And for me, having only a couple of years really in permaculture, though I spent about a decade reading before I really dove in and took a PDC and moved forward, I know that I still have quite a few aha moments where these ideas that are presented in the designer's manual or reading some of David Holmgren's work, where I just don't get it. And then while I'm out there working, doing something, there's a little connection there. Though I can have those conversations in a course, speaking with other students, someone such as yourself with all of your experience, it still takes time to do that, and you can't compress that into that PDC experience. There's still that personal journey that you have to follow to make all of it work.
That's right. You know, the permaculture design course is really kind of like that falling in love stage, the romance stage in education, in which you fall in love with a subject or a topic. And then there's the how do you incorporate that into your life, and how do you maintain and sustain that relationship after the romance kind of fades, you know, and which is when it really gets rich. I still have those aha moments myself. Even 30 years on, it's like, oh, gosh, you know, I mean, one of the more recent ones for me was that really permaculture was the only food production system that I'm aware of that actually looked at human nutrition and what do people need in terms of food and the diversity of food sources and things like that to provide a nutritionally complete diet. I don't think that's really addressed anywhere else. And Mollison certainly was very much into human nutrition. He wrote that book, Ferment and Human Nutrition, somewhere around the time the Designer's Manual came out or shortly thereafter. So this is something that I think often gets overlooked when we talk about permaculture, is it was really a dynamic system about how do we really meet our human nutritional needs as individuals as well as communities. So I've been pushing that pedal to the floor pretty hard.
Human nutrition being one of your focuses over the last several years, with this long depth of experience that you have going back, what work are you focusing on now in the present?
A few things. One of the main things that I do right now is I do some educational work. I teach some workshops at conferences and things along those lines, particularly like organic farming conferences and organic growers conferences and things like that. And I'm always interested in pushing out the edges beyond just what might be considered permaculture orthodoxy. So I continue to do that work. I also have a design and consulting practice. There's another piece of that that is both regional as well as international in scope. And I started a permaculture-based plant nursery back around 2000 here at Earth Haven Eco Village. And that nursery's focus has been about providing access to these super nutritious plants that we really need to have available to us if we're going to sustain ourselves in good ways. And then the thing I think is one of the most exciting things I'm doing right now is work in some of the two-thirds world to bring permaculture to greater prominence in terms of how people can provide livelihoods for themselves off the land without eroding or destroying the land's potential to feed future generations. And so my primary area where I've been working, and that has been in Jamaica, where I've been working with a young eco-village community there called Source Farm in St. Thomas Parish in Jamaica. And they've been really wonderful allies in that process. I first met them when I went over there to help them do a permaculture land use plan for their property. And because of my experience in founding an eco-village and in the eco-villages movement, I helped them with some of their organizational issues around how do you start something like this. That has carried on into last year. Andrew Goodhart Brown and I went to Jamaica with, and Source Farm was pretty much the organizational people, and particularly Nicola Shirley, who's a real mover and a shaker in that realm, to have the first permaculture design course in Jamaica in probably about 25 years. That's led to the beginnings of a permaculture movement on the island and continues to expand in that way. So I'm really nourishing that process along. And one of the ways that I'm doing that is by periodic visits to the island and doing workshops and teaching gigs, but also some consulting work and as well as some community organizing work with Source Farm on how do we move this stuff forward. One of the things that I'm most excited about right now in terms of that work is developing what I call farmer-to-farmer exchanges, in which we bring experienced organic farmers and appropriate technology people, primarily my friends from the southeastern United States, because those are the ones that I know the best, and set up a mechanism so that they can go to Jamaica and teach and advise young Jamaican farmers in good permaculture practice and good organic farming methodologies and things like that. So we build an information and cultural exchange program between where we live and, you know, starting in Jamaica, and hopefully that'll expand into other areas of the Caribbean that are, you know, underserved at this point.
In this process, when you're doing the work in Jamaica, is this mostly a private partnership, or do you also have public buy-in from the local government?
At this point, it's mostly a private partnership. You know, I think that sometimes you find that some of these well-entrenched government organizations, like their Department of Agriculture and stuff like that, don't necessarily have the perspective that even the interest in changing things up too much. Not that we wouldn't be happy to work with them, but I just haven't found the good partners there in that work. And we'll hopefully build that relationship over time. But I'm not a big believer that government is going to save us. In fact, I'm pretty well convinced at this point that it's not, and that individual initiatives among impassioned and committed people have a lot more opportunities to really implement long-term social, cultural, and food security changes than, you know, a lot of entrenched organizations that tend to get, you know, tied up in a lot of politics. I'd like to move beyond most of that.
Working with the private sector and private funding, you can avoid most of that?
I think so. And part of this farmer-to-farmer exchange program is actually trying to take advantage of a program in the USAID, actually call the farmer-to-farmer program, in which they basically will cover volunteers' expenses in going and working with farmers and community groups that are engaged in agricultural endeavors. They found it to be a really cost-effective way to get information out there. And really, information is the big limiting factor in most of the two-thirds world. Most people don't have access to the information that we have in America and in the more developed countries in a lot of these places. So a lot of my work is to make sure that they have access to the information they need to make informed decisions that are going to support their well-being and the well-being of the land, and provide a opportunity for future generations to actually thrive and prosper, as well as by developing these right relationships with the landscapes in their care. So using USAID's farmer-to-farmer exchanges, and these programs are all over the world. There are agencies that work using this farmer-to-farmer program throughout Eastern Europe, Africa, South and Central America, the Caribbean, you know, in Asia, to get U.S. volunteers over there. And what I'm trying to do, and a lot of that, those volunteers in the past have been fairly conventional agriculturalists. And what I'm interested in doing is using that program to actually expand the reach of organic farmers and permaculturalists and people that have got real gifts in appropriate technology like biochar and alternative energy solutions, to be able to share their gifts and the knowledge they've accumulated over a lifetime with these people that are in need of that knowledge and information to bootstrap themselves up. I mean, the Jamaican organic agriculture movement is still a young movement, and they could really benefit from the experiences of the organic agriculture community in North America and what they've learned over 30 years, so they don't have to repeat the same mistakes and kind of bootstrap themselves on our efforts and move forward towards creating successful ecological agriculture ventures that'll be a benefit to them as well as their community, and not erode and destroy the landscape in their care, which is a lot of what's going on right now. The erosion is just awful.
When you do this international work, do you find that there's buy-in from the people who you're working with, or do you have to convince them of the viability of this path? And I say that because here in the United States, it seems in some environments we've reached kind of a tipping point where there's pushback against some of the organic and ecological design movements. Depending on who I talk to, if I mention the word permaculture, that sometimes just that word can shut down the conversation because of perception.
Mm-hmm.
But from other people, depending on where they are in the world, they find that it's easier for these movements to develop in places like South America or Africa than in their own backyard in the United States.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. It's one of the reasons that I'm focusing more of my attention on this international work, because they're so much more receptive, because the need is greater. Americans really aren't hungry or desperate enough yet to really fully embrace a lot of these things. And you will hear some of the same arguments sometimes in Jamaica that, you know, we heard in the organic agriculture movement 20, 30 years ago, oh, you can't do it organically. Some of the same territories is out there. There's going to be some pushback, and there's also a need to develop market demand and things along those kind of lines, too. But, you know, the establishment has got a lot invested in their worldview and their development of their professional understandings in particular areas. So they don't always take kindly to anybody who kind of questions that. And this is something that Bill Mollison in the early days dealt with a lot, but the agricultural establishment and he were at war for years in Australia. You know, they poo-pooed permaculture and its importance or its validity or its, even whether it would work. And over time, that shifted as people watched it work. And so now Bill Mollison's a national hero in Australia, and permaculture is a word that most people there probably know what it means now. So, you know, there's always going to be that in any movement. You're going to find resistance from the forces that are established, you know, those people that are interested in making sure that they continue to be able to sell their chemical fertilizers or pesticides or genetically modified seeds or whatever it might happen to be along those lines. And we just have to kind of, from my perspective, rather than direct confrontation, much better to do an end run around that. And just go off and work with the people and set up our own organizations to support the work that we're about and not fret too much about that other. And then, you know, cooperate with those people that want to cooperate. You know, Bill Mollison always said, work where it counts. Don't waste your time trying to convince chemical agriculture farmer that you're not going to be convinced anyway. Find those people that are open to listening and who want to change their lives for the better and work with them. And there's certainly ample opportunities in two-thirds rural countries to do that.
One thing that you mentioned earlier about the work at the Source Farm was about building an eco-village, and that you have experience doing that. I was able to go and browse the Earthhaven website, and it was feels a bit serendipitous because this weekend I was talking with some friends about their desire to build an intentional community. And that was the first time that I had encountered Diana Leaf Christian's book, Creating a Life Together.
Yep.
Which was very, if I forget how exactly it was presented to me, but it was not fluffy. It was a very hard presentation of what's required to build an eco-village.
That's right.
And looking at the website for Earthhaven, it's very clear what your lines are, your delineation, how it's organized, what fees are associated to become a member. Very business-like, very practical, not at all what I was expecting from some of the intentional communities that I was familiar with from like the 60s and 70s and the stories my parents and grandparents told.
We've learned a lot in the past 30 years. All of those things that you referred to are hard-learned lessons. It's taken a lot of work to get there. Really, the idea of forming a community is not for the faint of heart. For those people that don't have almost a stubborn commitment to what it is they're trying to found. And that's critical in the early stages in particular. But, you know, it's been a learning curve and a pretty intense learning curve. Even though some people describe Earthhaven as an intentional community, and certainly it is a community of intent, I like to separate out the eco-village model from the intentional community model, because I think there's a big difference at the core of that. And while there's a lot of cross-fertilization between those subsets of the intentional communities movement, there's some real differences there. And I guess if I could say one thing about the intentional communities model doesn't necessarily serve them in creating a model that is going to be widely adopted by most people in the Western world, is it has been pretty much human-centric. In other words, focused a lot on process and human relationships and conflict resolution and a number of those things, which certainly get incorporated into eco-villages because we need that information on how do people get along and how do we design these lives together. The eco-villages movement is a much broader movement than just that, which is about, okay, what are the human settlement forms that are going to carry us into the future? What are going to be the ways that we live together in right relationship, not only with each other, but also with the natural world and the landscapes in our care? I'm actually much more interested in the village conversation, which is really about, okay, villages are the way that most humans have lived throughout most of human history and even into the 21st century. And what can we learn about the village wisdom from traditional peoples from all over the world who've been living in villages for literally thousands of years together? And so that becomes much more interesting in terms of a conversation for me. Is intentional community is not enough. We have to really look at a village model.
Would it be fair to say then that you see the eco-village movement as an extension or an outward growth from the intentional communities, or kind of its own separate movement?
Well, I think it's its own movement, and I think that there's a lot of cross-fertilization between the two. Now, I know that some people would disagree with me on this, but I see the eco-village movement as a direct outgrowth of the permaculture movement. That's really where it began. It began with one of my teachers, an Australian man named Max Lindegger, who started Crystal Waters Eco-Village, really the first eco-village in the world at that time, and has since grown into a really vibrant movement that's got where eco-villages are in the process of evolving on just about every continent but Antarctica, because it just makes good sense, and it really applies a lot of the permaculture principles and practices that, you know, can be used to grow food or provide for our own resources. It takes it to the next level of human settlement patterns. And that's much more interesting and has a bigger vitality, in my opinion, than does just intentional communities. There's a rich history of intentional communities, but they've always been marginal. And my hope would be that this eco-village movement, as it plays itself out, will, some places it's played itself out in much more of a mainstream kind of way, even urban ways. It's not limited to rural areas or anything along those kind of lines.
In building Earthhaven over the past two decades and now your work with The Source Farm, what have been some of your biggest challenges and biggest rewards in building eco-villages?
Well, as a permaculturalist, I kind of look at limiting factors. And what are those limiting factors? Is it, in case of permaculture design, is it climate? Is it light? Is it soil nutrition? Is it economic? Anything along those kind of lines is what you need to look at. And in the eco-villages movement, you know, a lot of this stuff we already know how to do. The biggest limiting factor, in my opinion, is for people who maybe don't have a history together, a life history or even familial history or anything along those kind of lines. How do we learn to live together? How do we, you know, learn to trust each other? How do we learn to cooperate? And so that involves a lot of personal growth and emotional maturity, as Diana would say in her book, because I really feel like the biggest limiting factor in most human endeavors is not how do we create the physical realities or even the economic constructs. It's really the limiting factors, our own preconceived notions and all the judgments about how the world works that we bring into these things, you know, the limiting factors between our ears, not in the physical environment at all. I mean, laying out the roads and the home sites and choosing the agricultural areas and things like that are the easy part. The traditional permaculture design roles are the easy part of doing a community or an eco-village. The challenging parts are, how do we deal with all the traumas and mistrust and negative life experiences that, you know, we all bring in the door with us when we walk into this? And so, in my mind, it would be great if we could just kind of get that stuff straight and move on with it, but that's not really how it works. I mean, even here at Earthhaven, we're continually challenged with conflict and different ideologies and our own judgments of each other and our challenges with trusting these people that we're in some ways essentially almost like married to. We put our lives into their hands, and some people prove to be trustworthy for putting your life in their hands, and others, you know, make us really, you know, a lot more challenging, and we wonder whether that's really a good idea. So those are some of the kind of issues, and I think, you know, the village model can deal with that in a different way than sometimes maybe the intentional communities model would. I mean, if you look at why people gather, they gather for any number of reasons, but, you know, protection from the outside world, economic opportunity, those kind of things are often the reason that people have traditionally gathered together. But they have had a lot longer to evolve those relationships that we have, so that the actions of one person don't necessarily create real challenges to the rest of the people that are living in a community.
And that's something, as you build villages and move past that first and second generation, with what you're learning about communicating and those inter and intrapersonal issues, do you think that that will get easier moving forward?
I think it will. I think it's probably a problem of pioneers. And so the pioneers are the ones that are, you know, gutsy enough to even try something like this. And my hope and prayers are that the future generations that come along behind us, it will build a fertile enough topsoil that they'll be able to thrive, and we won't make such big mistakes that will hamper future generations' ability to determine their own futures within the context of the village.
Well, and our pioneers are the ones that are weedy and grow where they want to, go in directions we might not want them to, and are thorny and kind of take some time to wrangle as our ecosystem matures, so.
That's right. Yeah, and another, you know, definition of a pioneer is, you know, how can you tell a pioneer? You can tell a pioneer by all the arrows in their back. You know, as they're out there challenging and questioning and trying new things, it makes some people uncomfortable, and so they get shot at a lot. And their ability to endure all that and to even thrive in the face of it goes a long way towards being able to succeed at any of these kind of endeavors.
And as long as you and everyone else who is devoted to this process, both where you are and all over the world, continue to do what you do, it'll show others the viability of these options.
Well, that's our hope. You know, once again, somebody has to get it started, but then we can, just in the same way that we can learn from other permaculturalist experience, the same should apply to the eco-village movement, that the people that are trying to pioneer eco-villages today can certainly bootstrap on the efforts of those that came before us. Now, when we started Earth Haven, I always figured that, okay, we're going to get out here, we're going to make a lot of mistakes, we're going to have a long learning curve, and hopefully those folks that come along trying to start communities after us will be able to benefit from those mistakes and experiences that we've had and not have to repeat those mistakes. They'll certainly have plenty of their own mistakes to make. I mean, that's how we learn. But, but that's how you really build a movement, is, you know, an advanced human culture and society, is to not have to keep repeating the same mistakes over and over and over again. So one of the biggest problems I think we face is what I would call intergenerational transfer of knowledge and skills. And that's particularly true, I think, in America, in which we've experienced a great de-skilling of many of the practical skills that we'll need both now and into the future as we adapt to and come to terms with the human-wrought challenges of our world. So, you know, how do we make sure that this hard-fought experience and knowledge and understanding gets passed on to those that come after us so that they can also benefit, you know, from that and not have to go back to where we did?
I think that these kinds of conversations are important for that, to get this out there and to get people thinking about it and in the know. There are many things that you've touched on today that are pieces that I was not familiar with before we started talking. And I can think to my own life and that intergenerational transfer of knowledge, that my grandfather taught my father certain things so that he wouldn't have to do what his father did, And then my father taught me certain things so that I wouldn't have to do what he did to get where he is. But I look at how many skills have been removed from my grandfather and my great-grandfather's generation to the point where I am, where I've gone to being a knowledge worker, where it's all information, but there aren't a lot of feet on the ground, hands in the problem kind of skills, because I have several generations that were moving in a direction where it was all about, you're going to be college-educated, white-collar, if you encounter any of these problems, and this long laundry list of things that my ancestors could do, it was, well, you'll just call somebody to do that because you won't face the same financial hardships we did, and you'll be able to pay someone else to do this. But as we found in the last couple of years, the economy has never really necessarily been all that stable or something reliable.
No, it hasn't. And we're actually getting to discover all the fallacies of those ideas that we were more or less sold to us. And we, in some ways, naively accepted, you know, that there was something wrong with working with your hands for a livelihood, and that the life in rural areas was brutish and terrible. And, you know, we'd be much better off if we just go work in a factory. And, of course, we now see that, that the corporations didn't keep their social contract around that. And this story repeats itself again and again and again throughout recent human history, that people buy a myth, a false myth, that actually, you know, the skills that are necessary to be a good farmer are simple or, you know, whatever, in which in many cases are much more complex than the skills of a factory worker, for sure. So we've really been dumbed down and de-skilled, and we've bought into some false belief systems, and those things are coming back to bite us now. So part of the work at this point is really to be able to try to recover some of this indigenous wisdom or elder wisdom and some of these primary basic skills for self-reliance, so that we're not dependent upon the economic system that really doesn't have the best interests of the individual at heart in most cases. And, you know, we end up functioning as essentially volunteered slavery in many cases to the system that's not really looking out for interest because it's not keeping up its end of the social contract. So it's time to fall back and see what worked in the past and see what that might have to do with creating healthy communities today. The level of cooperation in rural societies is much higher than it is in our modern post-industrial world, in which, you know, we've all isolated ourselves in our little boxes and created these little security zones for ourselves and stopped talking to our neighbors, and we've come to value independence over interdependence. And, you know, anybody who's done any study of ecology or ecosystems will understand that the species with the best survival potential are those that have the broadest range of networks of cooperation. In other words, interdependence is a better survival strategy than independence any day of the week. And we ignore that at our own peril. So one of the ways that I look at the health of a culture is how many generations away from knowledge of self-reliance or self-sufficiency skills it happens to be. At this point, you know, you pointed out your grandfather and your father and you. So, you know, in America, it's a good 2 to 3 generations away from those skills that really we're going to need to move into an uncertain future. And so really hasn't done us any favors, you know, most of these belief sets that we've bought into. Whereas if you go to somewhere like Jamaica or the island of Dominica in the Caribbean, you find that in many cases, these societies, the skill sets are still existing to a certain level, and at most maybe a generation out. The step for them towards sustainability is actually a much shorter step than it is for us in many cases.
I think it's a really nice message as we bring this interview to a close. I don't want to keep you away from your grandchildren and your visitors for much longer. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to our conversation?
I think that basically what we need to do is have a bit of a context of where we're at and where we want to go. And this brings me to something that I learned from Toby Hemingway several years ago when I watched a video of a talk he did at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, in which he talked about horticultural societies. And once Toby kind of put me onto this, it's kind of become another passion of mine, and I've begun to see permaculture in a whole new light because of it. And he looks at human social evolution from the hunter-gatherer or forager lifestyles that humanity practiced for a good portion of our human social evolution. And then there was this period when we first began to settle and practiced a combination of some of these foraging practices, like gathering wild vegetables and some hunting from wild lands, and began to settle and develop gardens and around the places that we lived. And then this horticultural society phase is usually ignored in the story of human societal evolution. Like, we jumped straight from hunter-gatherers into agricultural and pastoralist societies, and they totally skipped this piece around horticultural societies. And then we became engaged in agricultural societies, and that's when civilizations arose. And now we moved into industrial societies, which is just a gloss on top of agricultural societies, really. It's more of the same: concentration of wealth and power and accumulation of wealth and decline in human nutrition and decline in human sovereignty and all those things that it's led to. So I've been kind of exploring this, and in a nutshell, it comes down to this, which is, in the long-term picture of human survival, gardens trump agriculture in every way, and villages trump civilizations in every way. Just to give you one example of that, we can look at Mayan societies. And when Mayan societies disintegrate, you know, the way we usually hear about this, well, the Mayan societies declined because they exhausted their food base or whatever, and then the civilization came to an end. Well, the Mayan people didn't come to an end when the civilization collapsed. They just went back into the woods and back to their villages and farms, or they migrated to other places where they could establish villages and farms. And there's some evidence they got as far north as the Appalachians of northern Georgia in their migratory patterns. But the people didn't go away. Anybody who's been to the Yucatan knows that the Mayan people are still there. The civilization is what collapsed and got covered over by jungles and things like that. But the people didn't go away. They went back to their gardens and villages. And this story has been repeated again and again and again. You know, civilization and metropolises are generally a bad idea. They don't last for that long. And when they collapse, then the people don't just go away. They just return to what they were doing before. So it makes sense for us to look at where are the models that we can use for inspiration and guidance on into the future. And doing some research into horticultural societies is probably our best shot at long-term sustainability for humanity. It deserves much more attention than it's getting. The other piece that I'd like to say around that is all these movements that we see going on around us, whether it's permaculture, organic gardening, community gardens, farm-to-school programs, the back-to-the-land movement, the restoration of skilled craftsmen, all of those things are what I would call a neo-horticultural revival. And one of the things that I don't think that we do a real good job of at present is recognizing both the context in which these movements exist and our connection under a big umbrella. We tend to think, well, here's permaculture over here, and here's organic farming over here, and here's biodynamics over here, and here's community gardens over here. But they all really exist under this big tent, which is what I would call the neo-horticultural revival. This group of individuals and communities that recognize that these are important skill sets to have, and for our own collective survival and thriving, not just survival, but actual our ability to thrive. And so these movements actually are part of a larger revival in these skills and practices of sustainability and regeneration, which is much more important than sustainability in terms of a concept, because so often we think of educated people look at the effect of humans on the biosphere and things like that, we see all the damage that humans have wrought due to their bad behaviors or selfish or self-serving behaviors. But there's a deeper story to that, and that can be found among many traditional peoples, and that's the way that the traditional peoples manage landscapes for long-term survival. And so we need to embrace a deeper concept, which is regeneration. Regeneration is much more important as a concept than sustainability. Sustainability just means to maintain that which we've already engaged in. Regeneration means that there's actually potential for humans to restore the world to health and abundance through our actions, and that our place on the planet is not just destructive, but it can be highly restorative, you know, if we proceed with intelligence and compassion and understanding and the desire to take our place within the web of life. We can actually, through our actions, restore landscapes to health and abundance. And this is really what I would call the promise of permaculture, is that through careful, knowledgeable, experienced, informed actions, we can actually restore this tattered web of life that has been rent asunder by human activities over the past few hundred years.
From that, it sounds like you truly took Bill's word to heart, to take permaculture and this idea that he was sharing with you and giving to you as a gift, and taking it out in the world and growing it and moving it beyond what it was into something more.
Yes, that's kind of what I've attempted to do to the best of my ability and will do to my last breath, because it's a worthy cause. And, you know, it's a big enough mission to fill a lifetime, in fact, many lifetimes with this work. And my commitment is not necessarily so much to present generations as it is to assuring that future generations have the opportunity to inhabit a beautiful, abundant garden planet. So that's what I devote my life to, is that work.
Thank you for devoting yourself to this work and taking the time to have this conversation with me and my listeners.
Oh, it's my delight and pleasure, Scott.
I really appreciate that, Chuck. This has been a really good conversation. I have so much information, as always, every time I talk to someone, to go back and share with the world.
Oh, well, thank you for your work and choosing to share it in the way that, you know, really multiplies all of our efforts exponentially. And that's what we really need to be doing. Getting the knowledge is a limiting factor, and we need to make sure that that knowledge and information is out there for all.
Well, I'll do my best to get this out there. Please keep doing the wonderful work that you are, and I'll be in touch and follow up with you about your work in Jamaica and how things are at the Source Farm sometime.
Yeah, that'd be great. Love to share more on that.
All right. Well, thank you for taking this time to talk with us.
And thank you, my brother.
As often happens with the interviews, as much discussion takes place while not recording, and lots of material never directly makes it into the show because those candid moments aren't in a structured form, and for a glimpse behind the microphone, can be impenetrable or totally unrelated to the direct topic. Realizing this and the need in some cases for additional context or clarity brings these additional notes from me, your intrepid podcast host. In the case of this conversation with Chuck, he presented an alternative to eco-villages that extends the idea of a neo-horticultural revival with a world where we're more interdependent, self-reliant, and skilled, so that we would be able to remake a world built by hand, if necessary, or just really to build a better world. Part of that idea is to re-inhabit our small towns and depressed city neighborhoods. For people who are interested in reviving lost arts, resiliency, and to lift ourselves up, we can go to areas where the economic misfortunes of the past several years took a toll and integrate into those communities and help to reshape and rebuild them, rather than collecting a group of like-minded people together and going off and forming our own separate eco-village, but rather be out there and in an area that you can be a part of and increase the network of people who work with and assist one another. That you can take this network of people that you know who are interested in doing this kind of work, and as you resettle somewhere else, make those connections with your neighbors, introduce them to your friends, and build outward from your own personal community while still being able to take your personal support structure with you. Though I do think a place of concern with this is, depending on where you go, gentrification or bringing your ideas with you in a way that could feel like they're imposed to others if the town or community you move to doesn't necessarily share your ideas and values. And I think of Scott Kellogg in gentrification, and I think of Seth Wilner with his idea of getting buy-in and cooperating, that you can go in with an opinion, but meeting people where they're at, which also touches on the interview with Ethan Hughes about how they have their principles, but that when they're aiding others, they meet them where they're at, and that their activism and other outreach is separate from helping their neighbors, and that those are all things that we need to be mindful of as we take these messages and ideas out into larger communities. And don't be afraid to investigate the broad and historical perspectives of an area before you do this. You may find that there are certain ideas that are entrenched that may not make your mission and methods as productive as they might elsewhere. Also, use models that work, whether that's something like Will Allen's Growing Power or the Garden Angels in Detroit. Whatever you can do to show that this works, do it. Provide your own inspiring examples. When you do, you give others hope through the good work you do. And I'd love to hear from each and every one of you about the good work that you're doing to change and build a better world. In the meantime, did this interview spark some ideas of your own? Do you have questions for Chuck that you would like answered in a future interview? Have a thought on permaculture ideas that you want to bounce off of someone? Feel free to contact me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or call and leave a voicemail, or maybe even talk to me if I'm around to answer. And that number is 717-827-6266. If you can take 2 minutes, go to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support and find out how you can make a donation to the show and help me keep the lights on and my internet connection up and running so I can continue doing these interviews and bringing shows to you regularly. My next interview is going to be with Dan French, an Australian permaculturist who shares his insight and advice on starting a permaculture business. I contacted him due to an excellent article posted at the Permaculture News. You'll find a link to that article in the show notes for this episode at thepermaculturepodcast.com. In the meantime, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.